Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. November 11th was Veterans Day in America, but for those who have served in the armed forces and the many who appreciate that service, every day is Veterans Day, including today. One very costly issue that some veterans have to deal with is an incorrectly reported discharge status, preventing them from receiving benefits and services. WEKU's Samantha Morrill has spoken with somebody who has made it his mission to fix this problem.
I'm here with Dennis Shepard. He's general counsel for the Kentucky Department of Veterans Affairs, and in the past few years, he's developed a specialty, if you will, in helping veterans correct or upgrade their discharge status. Dennis, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
So tell us, if you will, how do veterans end up with an inaccurate discharge status?
Well, of course, most veterans already know the most important document they leave the service with is the DD Form 214, and that's their record. That includes their service characterization, honorable, general, or lower, and also their awards and decorations. And many times when they leave the service, they don't check that form, and it becomes a burden on them when they have mistakes on that form.
And why wouldn't a veteran check these papers or know to check these papers as soon as they're out of service?
Well, in one case, it's because of bad information. And I remember I'm a veteran myself. I was an officer, and I was also an enlisted troop. And we're told as we get out of the service different things by different first sergeants, by different commanders. And in many cases that I've run across, a veteran is told, don't worry about it. You have a bad discharge, but it's automatically upgraded in 6 months. That is completely false. So they leave the service really with bad information. Not everyone, not a whole lot, but enough that had they checked their DD Form 214, had they checked into the rules of upgrading discharges, they would know the truth. And it's when they come into my office that I try to explain those things to them.
And when do they find out that they have this issue, that their status is incorrect or inaccurate?
The biggest category of veterans that discover that they had a problem with their exit from the military service is when they go to the VA, to the medical centers, and attempt to get benefits, health care, or they try to get disability ratings through the VA, pensions through the services. And they find out they're not eligible.
If they come in with these low discharge statuses, how can they be discharged in this way and then have those taken back and upgraded and corrected? What kind of circumstances would they be in for that to happen?
The reasons vary. I mean, you can have somebody who suffered from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, from combat. And because of that, they can't conform their conduct to the military. And they get out of the service with a discharge that's bad. When I see those cases, I try very hard to help those veterans show that their misconduct in the service was directly related to post-traumatic stress disorder. There are mistakes about sexual orientation on DD Form 214s. I've seen homosexual misconduct placed on a DD Form 214, and I've had it erased through this application process. There are some women and some men who suffered from military sexual trauma, and because of that, they get a bad discharge because they can't conform their conduct to military regulations after they've been assaulted, because that lives with them. And I've helped people like that go through the application process. Many reasons, and they should always look for help when they think they qualify for an upgrade or for a correction of their military record.
There is sometimes a real stigma that comes with having a low discharge status, dishonorable, or whatever it may be. Do the veterans that you help, do they report after getting this corrected or upgraded that 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 has been lifted, that there's some relief for them in that way?
You would never believe what a burden it takes off of their mind. I'll give you one example. I had a Vietnam veteran, and we were able to upgrade his discharge. He'd been AWOL, absent without leave from his unit, for something like 9 months. And we were able to get his discharge upgraded to an honorable discharge. Prior to that, he had not voted for decades. He thought that a bad discharge meant he could not vote. And when it was upgraded, not only did he have that stigma removed, he was now entitled to VA benefits. Another example, also a Vietnam veteran, we were able to upgrade that person's discharge, not only qualified for VA health care, but was able to get a retro benefit, meaning back pay for the years that he was still entitled to it, of about $120,000. So yes, the burden is lifted greatly for these veterans who for years were walking around with a bad discharge.
We've mentioned Vietnam veterans and others. Are you seeing younger veterans who are finding the same issues with their paperwork?
It kind of goes across the board. There are many reasons for upgrading, many reasons for correcting, but you're absolutely right. Yes, we do get Vietnam veterans to help, but by and large, today we're dealing with this new generation of those who serve our country, put their life on the line in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria, and they come out with a bad discharge because of mental illness caused by the combat itself.
Dennis Shepherd, General Counsel for the Kentucky Department of Veterans Affairs, thanks so much for being with us today.
Sure. Anytime.
To learn more, you can visit veterans.ky.gov or call 502-564-9203. By the way, EKU has received a grant from the Kentucky Department of Veterans Affairs to establish a Veteran Student Emergency Trust Fund. The fund awards micro-grants of up to $500 for students who are experiencing financial emergencies due to a delay of benefits. It's the only program of its kind in Kentucky. David Albright joins us from the University of Alabama School of Social Work, where he is an endowed chair in mental health research and director of the Office for Military Families and Veterans. Dr. Albright is a featured speaker in this year's EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series. He'll be on the EKU campus this evening, last Thursday, if you're listening to our Sunday rebroadcast, to speak on the topic, Building Resilience and Finding Balance, Mental, Mindfulness, and Veterans Mental Health. Welcome, Dr. Albright.
Hey, thank you so much, Tom.
And before we dig into your topic, do I understand correctly that you have some Kentucky roots, correct?
Yes. My mother's family is from Bell County, Middlesboro, with her parents having spent their professional years in Louisville. I attended Center College in Danville. I'm also an Army vet, one who's proud of my service and particularly thankful for veteran-friendly schools like Eastern Kentucky University. Its Veteran Studies program is the first of its kind in the country and personifies the university's dedication to high-quality instruction, scholarship, and service.
We thank you for your service and for your continued focus on veterans' issues. And when you speak at EKU on the 21st, you will be discussing mental health among military veterans. So let's begin with what you have identified as the benefits of service in this regard.
Veterans leave the service with three key strengths: a sense of tribe, a sense of purpose, and a sense of identity. Tribe is that sense of knowing who you would give your last bit of food to. Purpose is that sense of accomplishment from external sources, and work or some form of service often gives veterans that sense of purpose. Purpose in life gives a sense of identity. A veteran strongly connected to his or her sense of purpose may think, I'm someone willing to write a blank check, payable with my life on behalf of our nation. I'm someone capable of doing so much more physically than I ever imagined. I'm someone who puts service before self. Your sense of tribe, purpose, and identity goes through flux during the military to civilian transition. But if you remain intentional about their development, and if you're fortunate enough to have access to the mentors, employers, and services you need, you'll join the majority rank of those who go on to experience a successful transition.
So these are some character or personality tells, if you will, that we all might recognize as something that is specific to a veteran. Are there some little things that we might be able to see in a person to say, you know, that person served?
Yeah. So this trio of strengths, if you will, tri, purpose, and identity, can show up in powerful ways when a service member leaves the military. So when you're looking around, upon separation from service, 99% of veterans in America say they want to serve in their communities. So I think one place that you might see some of this is when you're looking out in your communities and you're looking at individuals who are giving back. But service isn't the only place that many of these veterans excel. That discipline, leadership, and organizational background and skills that military service members bring home make them twice as likely to succeed in business ownership as their civilian counterparts. So another place you might see this are in those small business owners who are out there hustling, making a difference within their communities for the members in their communities. Many of them likely have some type of military service status or background. In the broader workplace, veterans are also a success. They tend to have higher salaries and advance more quickly in their jobs than non-veterans. The story of our veterans may not be so bleak after all, really. The support of educators like EKU and access to services across employment and healthcare really represent the core of a successful transition and where many of the viewers might look when they're looking for ways that veterans are manifesting strengths within their community.
Your talk on the 21st focuses on veterans' mental health, and I wonder, among veterans who struggle with mental health issues, what are some of the warning signs?
Yeah, if you talk to a veteran, you're going to find a range of experiences as diverse as the people who served. You know, many veterans return from their time in the service changed physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Training alone can transform you, but add to that injury, loss of your friends, a deployment or three, or sexual trauma, and that transformation can take on an edge. It might play out as depression, substance use, or post-traumatic stress. And these negative effects aren't wholly contained, right, within the bodies and minds of our veterans. Unfortunately, they can play out in family dynamics as a veteran mother. Interacts with her kid, or a veteran husband struggles to reignite empathy and intimacy with his family. These effects can play out in our workplaces as veterans struggle to find work or keep it because of physical or psychological injuries. So the take home here really is the ripple effect of trauma sustained in service can impact entire communities relationally and economically. However, many veterans also return for their time in service as effective leaders and citizens. For example, veterans are more likely than non-veterans to attend neighborhood meetings, solve problems, assume leadership roles in their local communities. They're more likely to vote. They tend to earn more than their civilian counterparts. And if they choose to start a business, they're twice as likely to succeed. As a group, veterans volunteer an average of 160 hours per year as compared to 120 hours by their non-vet counterparts. Got to remember, we hear a lot about post-traumatic stress in the media, but something we don't hear as much about is post-traumatic growth, this idea that you can return from trauma stronger than you were before. The growth is a reality for many of our service members. They hear the challenge, learn the lesson, pay the cost, and complete their service with added capabilities. But injured or whole, all have offered themselves as surrogates of war. They're responsible to each of us from that moment they take an oath of enlistment to the moment they arrive at their first duty station to the moment they return home.
I know that you talk about a trifecta of mental fitness. Tell us about this.
Well, the core message is simple. No matter who you are, resilience can be taught, practiced, and grown. The three pillars of a resilient life are social support, self-care, and spirituality. The individual value of these pillars is backed by science, and when practiced together, their benefits increase exponentially. Really think, though, it's important to keep in mind that the best care often starts with listening. When we drop our preconceived notions about what a veteran looks like, what the veteran experience looks like, and what kind of support a veteran might need, we become so much more powerful in our work. You know, I challenge everybody listening to the show today. Listen openly to veterans as they share their experiences with you. Accept veterans for who they are in the moment, regardless of where they are in their life or where you are in yours. Try to work to understand their backgrounds. You got to keep in mind that shame in so many forms tends to be pervasive among military folks. There's a shame that comes from not having served in the ways folks expect, or perhaps from actually having served in those ways. There's shame about surviving when your friends don't. Shame about struggling with addiction or substance use after trauma. Shame about the circumstances surrounding trauma. See, many of our veterans carry these multi-layered invisible wounds, which might also include the heavy burden of moral injury or for having been part of a war that's unpopular. Listening well, giving space to both the shame and pride can help lift a heavy burden and is needed to be able to facilitate this trifecta. It can allow you to connect with veterans with the resources they need most instead of the ones that we think they need. When we support them well, they're not the only people who are benefiting. It's also their partners, spouses, families, employers, entire communities.
David Albright is Hillcrest Foundation Endowed Chair in Mental Health Research and Director of the Office for Military Families and Veterans at the University of Alabama School of Social Work. And thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much, Tom.
Coming up after the break, Mary Meehan on endocarditis. Heard of it? Few had before the drug crisis made this often fatal heart condition a daily concern in area hospitals. And the debut report in our new Appalachian Reporting Initiative takes us to Hindman, Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Drug addiction disorder can carry all kinds of baggage, including endocarditis, at one time rare, now far too common. WEKU's Mary Meehan reports.
Dr. John Cotter worked as a cardiologist at the University of Kentucky Hospital. He did a paper on endocarditis in medical school because the infection of a heart valve was so uncommon. He says that's changed dramatically in the last few years.
It's a terrible problem that used to be rare and now is common, where we see cases almost every day.
Cotter says people injecting drugs often share unsterile syringes, and that is the main reason for the growing number of endocarditis patients.
The way endocarditis is transmitted most of the time, as we see it now, is with IV drug needles. People inject bacteria through the needles. It just comes in through their skin and spreads to their heart.
The structure of the heart itself makes endocarditis especially harmful.
Yeah, so endocarditis is, it's an infection of the heart. Most of the times it's an infection of the valves inside of the heart. So your heart has four valves, and they're really interesting because it's one of the few places in your body where you don't have normal immune system ability to fight infection.
Endocarditis treatment traditionally requires 6 to 8 weeks in the hospital to receive antibiotics. According to the National Institutes of Health, the bill for a single patient can run over $30,000. Cotter says it's also difficult to cure.
But with endocarditis, it's an infection that almost never gets better on its own. You have to have treatment, which usually is prolonged antibiotics and sometimes even surgical treatment to help clear out some of that infection.
Cotter says surgery has its own limits.
When you have infection inside of your heart that has to be surgically removed, you cut away all the infected and destroyed tissue, and then you sew a new valve into the healthy heart tissue that's left behind. When that valve, that new prosthetic valve, gets infected, the tissue around it also starts to get destroyed. And eventually you're left with a situation where you don't have enough healthy tissue to sew a new valve into.
Substance use disorder is a chronic relapsing disease, which means many patients require multiple surgeries.
Sometimes I think people start to feel like you do that, the patient goes home, they continue to use drugs, and they end up coming back with another infection. And there can be a natural feeling of, well, this is hopeless. Let's give up. Let's not continue to help people.
Cotter says that even with proper care, the prognosis is not good. About 30% of endocarditis patients are dead within a year of diagnosis. They are often young, between 20 and 30 years old. But Cotter says the crisis has resulted in a more holistic approach for treatment.
And I think what we've learned is that those decisions are so much better made in teams where we have multiple providers, whether it's a medical cardiologist or an infectious disease specialist or an addiction medicine specialist, that all are able to weigh in and say, this is what we think is really the best treatment for the patient, and certainly having good open discussion with the patient.
There is another bit of hope. Those at highest risk are more aware of the threat. Cotter says a patient recently said he didn't think he had endocarditis because he'd been taking antibiotics.
I don't think that's something we would have heard 5 years ago, because nobody in that population had heard of endocarditis. Now I think people know.
So while there's progress, there's still much work to be done. For Eastern Standard, I'm Mary Meehan.
One of our goals at WEKU and Eastern Standard is to increase coverage of underreported stories in Appalachia and Eastern Kentucky. To that end, we're starting a new segment this week, the Appalachian Reporting Initiative. Support for the ARI comes from the Bluegrass Pro Chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. Our first report comes from Will Wright, who covers Eastern Kentucky for the Lexington Herald Leader.
Within one of the storefront buildings along the sleepy main street of downtown Hindman in Knott County, a group of men curled over workbenches on a recent sunny afternoon and whittled pieces of hardwood into the familiar shapes of guitars and mandolins. Saws and chisels turn the wood into sawdust and it falls to the floor. The men talk as they work, asking each other about what tools they're using and what instruments they're making. When reporters ask why they're here, they're quick to open up. All of these men are recovering from drug addiction. Some came here through a local rehabilitation clinic, others came through drug court, a supervised treatment program offered to convicted criminals in lieu of jail time. Paul Williams, an instructor at the Appalachian School of Lutheran, gives some pointers.
Probably what we'll do is, we'll do the edge sander thing first. But what you want to do is you want to terminate this into the circle. So, like, right about like that.
The school recently opened its sister factory, the Troublesome Creek Stringed Instrument Company, just down the road. It's a big moment for the school's leadership and for some of the students. The factory hopes to grow to employ 60 people within the next 6 years, many of whom will be former students who went through the school's drug treatment program. If it succeeds, Troublesome Creek will be the largest manufacturing plant in Knott County in living memory. Earlier this year, the Appalachian Regional Commission awarded an $867,000 grant to help it get started. Nathan Smith, a gruff Knott County native and a coal miner's son, was hired on as one of its first employees. A graduate of drug court, Smith is the embodiment of what Troublesome Creek wants to represent. A chance for people with substance abuse disorder to turn their lives around, all while providing Hyman a similar hope for a brighter economic future.
When you suffer from addiction, it's harder to quit than what it seems. Especially with, depending on what you're using too, it's another thing. The methamphetamine is really hard to quit. But I knew when I did get in trouble, I knew that I was on a bad path, and if I didn't stop then, that I was going to wind up dead or in worse trouble.
Like many students at the Appalachian School of Lutheran, Nathan Smith ended up there after years of substance abuse led to his eventual arrest. Marijuana and alcohol led to harder things, including methamphetamine. And in August 2017, Smith was picked up during a countywide drug trafficking roundup. He spent about 10 days in jail before he posted bond. He fought his case for months, but eventually pleaded guilty and enrolled in Knott County Drug Court. Along with frequent drug tests, the court requires participants to take classes during the week. They gave Smith three options: blacksmithing, pottery, or the luthery. A musician, he opted for the luthery.
With the first instrument that I made, I was like, wow, I never imagined doing anything like that. And when I started watching them build the guitars and just different things like that, it kind of really intrigued me. So I decided it was something that I wanted to stick with.
The court required Smith to attend the school once a week for 2 hours, but within a couple months, Smith said he was hooked. He often showed up there at 8:30 or 9 in the morning to sweep and get the shop ready for the day, and he stayed for 8 hours or more. It helped keep him sober during drug court. He graduated in May of this year, and allowed him to build skills that would lead to his eventual employment at the factory.
It really helped me as far as my sobriety. I've been clean a little over 2 years now, and this has been a big help, really big help. And I knew that it would be when I real sat back and realized how many hours I was spending there and was enjoying it, and looking forward to coming back the next day. I knew that it would actually help me out in the long run. I never imagined it turning into a job like it has, but I stuck with it. It was just something that I had a passion for.
Smith doesn't see Troublesome Creek as just a chance to grow his own future. He wants it to help Hyman too. He said the limited number of well-paying jobs in Knott County plays a big role in the prevalence of drug addiction, including his own. The number of coal jobs in the county has dropped to a third of what it was in 2012, and the county's unemployment rate has, for years, remained well above the statewide average. According to a 2015 figure from the Kentucky Cabinet for Economic Development, more than 70% of working Knott County residents commute outside the county to find work. The factory, he hopes, could change that.
If this creates 60 jobs and the county starts to expand and grow and we get more revenue, maybe there'll be more things built here in the county that could help with the addiction, help with the opioid crisis. But it's gonna take something to create revenue to do that.
More than 20 years ago, Governor Paul Patton directed $25.2 million into Knott County, hoping to bolster the local art scene and help diversify an economy that relied almost exclusively on coal. Much of that money went to the Kentucky School of Craft, the building Troublesome Creek is housed in, and other public projects, including a new city hall and new water and sewer lines. But Patton's investments never led to the growth he imagined. Doug Naslerode, the Lutheran's director, thinks the Appalachian Regional Commission's investment in Troublesome Creek could finally help bring that vision to reality. Naslerode said he wants more than the obvious economic benefits of a mid-sized factory. He wants Troublesome Creek and its guitars to change the way people think about Appalachia, among people who live here and among people from the outside.
People should want to use Appalachian as a superlative instead of a derogatory term. I don't want people to say, well, there are some Appalachian guitars, in a negative way. I want them to look at our work and say, yeah, there are some Appalachian guitars. Those are the real deal.
Naslerode spends a lot of time thinking about how Troublesome Creek and the Appalachian School of Lutheran fit into the bigger picture of economic development in Eastern Kentucky. Over the years, people have grown accustomed to promises of large projects and companies moving to the region to employ hundreds of people and turn the economy around. But many of those projects have faltered. Just last year, a proposed battery plant called Enerblue said it would move to Pikeville and employ hundreds of people. Local and state politicians jumped at the chance to throw their support behind Enerblue, but the project folded, leaving local investors out more than $1 million with no jobs to show for it.
People keep falling for that over and over and over. I mean, maybe it's the people that are coming in don't really understand what they're trying to do, or maybe they're just being cynical and playing on the hopes of a community. But the fact is that those things almost always tank.
Nasal Road said Troublesome Creek is different. It will create fewer jobs, but it's rooted in local history, it's fueled by local residents craving a better future, and it's more manageable in scale.
I think that instead of having one shop that is going to bring in 1,200 jobs, it's a lot healthier for the economy to have 100 shops that are going to bring in 12 jobs each, because there's some real strength in that. It's like a mini plied cord. Instead of one soft, big soft rope that breaks, you're done. You know, if you have interwoven hundreds of small businesses in Appalachia that are robust, then you have a strong economy, even if you never have an input.
Back inside the factory, Nathan Smith works on his first full-size guitar. For Nasal Road, stories like Smith's, of people taking their lives back through honest work and a connection to music, those are the stories that will be etched into each guitar as they go off to market. He hopes that when people purchase them, it's stories like Smith's that they'll think of.
You sit down and think about what Troublesome Creek guitars are. They're made from locally sourced hardwoods by people, yes, who are in recovery, in a community that's in its own recovery. I mean, it's all about, healing. Organizationally and individually.
For WEKU and the Lexington Herald Leader, I'm Will Wright.
Coming up after a brief break, Turner West from Bluegrass Care Navigators on ethics and current practices in end-of-life care. And Lexington actor Kevin Hardesty on landing a lead role in the new feature film Not to Forget, shot on location in central Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
We're going to spend a few minutes now touching on what is for many of us a delicate subject, one that we tend not to consider until it's almost too late, end of life. The issues are often complex, moral, ethical, or legal dilemmas, or a combination of these concerning a patient's vital physiologic functions, medical surgical prognosis, quality of life, and personal values and beliefs. It's something that Turner West deals with on a daily basis as Associate Vice President and Director of the Palliative Care Leadership Center at Bluegrass Care Navigators, and he's here with us. Thanks for joining us, Turner.
Hey, Tom. My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to dig into your specialty, which is palliative, in just a few minutes, but before we get there, can you tell me a little bit about the big ethical issues that relate to end-of-life care that are currently under discussion in your world?
Yes, there are a range of ethical issues that are involved in this space. I think one of the more talked about ones recently is a physician aid in dying and how we should think about that as a society. Also, the concept of futile care for individuals at end of life and thinking about the benefits and burdens of particular treatment options. You know, here in Kentucky, we've obviously talked quite a bit about medical marijuana and what that may mean. And then there are access to care issues. So we think about, despite hospice being a benefit for the last 6 months of life, half of people who receive hospice care receive it for 17 days or less. And only about half of the individuals who die in Kentucky receive hospice care at all. And so we can think about access to care type issues as well.
Well, what are some of the more challenging issues that you've come across, that you've encountered in your work?
So we've been in this community for 40 years. The Medicare hospice benefit has been around since 1982. And despite that, we still have pervasive misconceptions about what hospice care is. And I think those misconceptions lead to an underutilization of hospice services. So there's the perception that hospice means that I'm giving up. And I wholeheartedly dispute that notion that hospice care is for the last days of life, and really it's for the last phase of life. So those misconceptions that hospice will give you morphine until you die, all those things are incorrect. So I think I run up against the misconception of what hospice is on a day-to-day basis, despite national efforts and local efforts to correct those pervasive misconceptions.
How does hospice care differ from palliative care?
Yeah, so it's a terrific question. Hospice care, we need to remember hospice care is a Medicare benefit. It's a benefit in the Medicaid program. Most commercial insurances have a hospice benefit, but there are restrictions on who can elect that benefit. So in the Medicare program, for instance, two physicians have to certify that the patient is terminally ill, which means if the disease follows its anticipated course, that the person will likely die in the next 6 months, and they have to waive coverage for curative treatments of their terminal diagnosis. So because of that, it's limited to individuals who are in the last 6 months of life. And we know there's a much broader number of individuals who are living with complex pain and symptom needs, who want to be in a home setting, who have psychosocial, spiritual needs that would benefit from the hospice-like services more upstream. And that's really that was what palliative care was born out of, which were the limitations of the Medicare hospice benefit, which is we know it benefits that patient population, but there's a much broader patient population that could benefit. But you can think of palliative care as specialized health care for individuals living with a serious illness. And the goal is to improve the quality of life for that person through expert pain and symptom management, through ongoing communication about, you know, what is important to you given your particular context, given your particular medical condition, and how can we as a team support you in developing a plan of care to meet any goals or again, what's important to you. So it looks a lot like hospice care, but it's for a much broader patient population.
Is it for both people who are experiencing serious illness mm-hmm. and those who are terminal, or is it really meant for those who are terminal?
Well, it is meant for individuals who are living with serious illness that can benefit from the specialization of the palliative care team. So we think about good palliative care is interdisciplinary. So typically the composition of a high-quality palliative care team is a physician who has specialized training in hospice and palliative medicine. The same way if you went to an oncologist, that oncologist brings expertise in understanding the physiology of cancer and the treatment and the side effects and all that sort of stuff. Our physicians are really experts in managing complex pain and symptoms. Similarly, we have nurses that have similar expertise, social workers that are responding to some of the psychosocial concerns that an individual and a family is facing, and then the spiritual existential concerns. So when somebody's diagnosed with a serious illness, they may have a spirituality that works positively for them, and they may also be struggling with that. And so to be able to understand the various forms of suffering that a particular person and family are dealing with when they're diagnosed with a serious illness is important, and to have trained, skilled clinicians that can respond to that is also critically important. Sometimes you have palliative care programs that take care of people through end of life, and that's primarily because there's misconceptions about what hospice is. But it's the goal is to find people much more upstream, because what happens when you don't have access to high-quality palliative care, it's often an exacerbation of pain and symptoms. It's utilizing the emergency department in the hospital to manage your medical condition, which is oftentimes not a great place for an older adult that's living with serious illness. It's oftentimes not what they want. So to be able to have a team-like approach that can go into a community setting is so important and beneficial to this particular patient population and their families.
In a book that they co-authored, and thank you so much for pointing it out to me, Dr. B.J. Miller and Shoshana Berger, say, acquiring a sense of reality that includes your own demise is actually a very enriching process. That seems counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But has that been your experience?
I think absolutely. And you've heard people say things, it's those individuals who are dying that teach us the most about living. And, you know, we live in a very death-denying culture, but we are aware of our own mortality and the mortality of those who are important to us. And I think by recognizing that particular fact on a day-to-day basis has implications for how we live our life. And in many ways, it inoculates us from some of our worst emotions. So if I recognize that I'm going to die, that the people that I care about are going to die, I don't take the experiences that I have on a day-to-day basis for granted. And I think in terms of living out values that are important to you, not living a life of regret, I think it does cultivate a sense of compassion for other individuals. And it increases the importance of the time that you have with those who are important to you. So I think Shoshana and BJ are right on the money. And BJ's TED Talk, which has millions and millions of views, really goes into this into much more detail. And it's really worth people's time and attention.
It is. They both have really compelling life stories
Yes.
that brought them together to begin with and then that culminated in that book. So I really recommend it. We'll put a link to that book on our website, esweku.com. It'll be on the facts and information page. So, again, we have this intuitive resistance in our culture, many of us, most of us probably do, to thinking about or discussing end of life for our loved ones, for ourselves. How do you advise us to handle it?
Yeah, I think there are a number of ways. Well, somebody in the family has to take this upon, recognize the importance of this and then figure out what's the right way to have these kinds of conversations with people to try to understand what would be important to them, what would they value in the context of living with a serious illness. And there are a number of tools out there that can help with that. So advanced care planning, we talk about the general umbrella topic for this is advanced care planning. And it doesn't have to be completing a Kentucky living will or doing anything necessary, you know, identifying a power of attorney. It's the most powerful thing can be conversation. So one tool that I know we have had some success with in our communities is something called the Conversation Project. And you can go to theconversationproject.org, I believe is the website. And there's a kit you can download to have it helps facilitate meaningful conversations with those who are important to you about their goals, preferences, and values. What would be important to you in the event you were diagnosed with a serious illness or a terminal illness? There's also something called a Hello Game, which is, I think that's exactly the title of it, the Hello Game, which it feels like a board game, but it's going to elicit, the purpose is to elicit insights for people that are important to you. But, you know, I think there are really adverse consequences to living in the death, to taking a death-denying approach. Mm-hmm. And you do it, I think it does a disservice at an individual level and at a societal level. So to be able to talk openly and honestly about these topics are important.
One thing I've found in our family's experience in several occasions, the icebreaker, if you will, and what got everybody around the table was to talk about a living will, about power of attorney, about do not resuscitate, which is a very difficult, but you have to have that conversation. That could be the springboard that leads into these other things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Turner West is Associate Vice President and Director of the Palliative Care Leadership Center at Bluegrass Care Navigators, and we appreciate you being with us, Turner.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Tom. Thank you so much.
We're joined in the studio by Lexington actor Kevin Hardesty. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Kevin recently landed a lead role in a new feature film shot in Central Kentucky, playing opposite Karen Grassley, that's Ma from Little House on the Prairie, and Oscar winners Tatum O'Neill and Lou Gossett Jr. So we need to hear all about that. That's pretty exciting stuff, Kevin. How did this come your way?
Tom, I got a text from an old friend of mine, Robbie Henson, who is the artistic director at Pioneer Playhouse in Danville. And he said that there was a feature film being shot there. He was doing some location scouting and also acting as sort of a local casting director. And he said, you know, I've read the script. There's a lead role here that I think you might really be right for, and you should come down and audition. I was out of town at the time, but he put me in touch with the director. So I just put together a short video clip of one of the scenes, sent it in. The director liked the work, sent me two more scenes to read with some direction. And 3 days later, he offered me the role, which was, I was a little shocked. There was a couple of big name actors up for it. So it was a stroke of fortune for me, but I just tried to make the most of it. It was fantastic.
Well, in just a second, I want to get into the experience of all that because it must be just incredible. But first, I was remiss in not saying in the introduction that on behalf of all of us who have been fortunate to experience your work on stage, we want to thank you for sharing such marvelous talent and congratulations on this accomplishment. Your work that I'm familiar with has been entirely on stage, but had you done film work in the past?
I had, Tom. I think this is actually the sixth feature film that I've worked on. I lived in Los Angeles years ago and worked in both film and television for a time. But it had been a while, but I wasn't entirely foreign to the experience, but and certainly not a role of this size. I mean, this was basically the third lead in the film, so yeah.
So this film was shot in Central Kentucky, entirely in Central Kentucky?
Primarily, I would say 90% of it was shot in Kentucky, primarily in and around Danville. We did some scenes in Perryville, Kentucky. The actual main set was a beautiful old farmhouse on a farm called Arcadia, which is in Stanford, Kentucky, mm-hmm. that operates as a sort of a bed and breakfast, a gorgeous historic home. And then there were some scenes after we wrapped here in Lexington. They were going to New York City to film a couple of scenes with yet another Oscar winner in the film, Olympia Dukakis, who plays the judge in the movie. Yeah.
The film title is Not to Forget, and you've kind of set the stage there. Can you tell us what the story is?
Yeah, the basic storyline, without giving anything away, because there are some surprises, it is about a woman with Alzheimer's disease, and her relationship with her caretaker slash farmhand, Joe, who's the character I play, and their relationship with her delinquent grandson, who has come to live with them on her Kentucky farm. He's been running these con jobs in New York City, gets arrested, and as part of his sentence, the judge sentences him to come back and help his grandmother on the farm in Kentucky.
So I have to ask that question that I'm sure you get hit with an awful lot. What was it like working with Tatum O'Neill and Lou Gossett Jr.?
You know, they were fantastic. I tell you what, it was interesting walking on that set, Tom, with some incredibly big names and some icons. But you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I felt ready for the opportunity. So we just worked together as actors, you know. Tatum O'Neill was fantastic. Lou Gossett Jr., I've never met a kinder, more generous actor in my life. Very down to earth, funny, generous, and an interesting actor. But I guess my favorite, only because I had the most screen time with her, was probably Karen Grassley, who, as you mentioned, was Ma from Little House on the Prairie. You know, I grew up watching her, and we just bonded, I mean, really from day one. Part of that is our theater backgrounds. I mean, she's a theater actor at heart. She went to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, where I was able to study as well. She started her career doing Shakespeare in England and was one of the first actors to do the New York Shakespeare Festival with Joe Papp. So a lot of stage background. And then got her big break with Little House. But even after that, in recent years, she was at Actors Theater of Louisville as a company player. So we bonded over the theater background. And I just learned a lot watching her, and I'm happy to say we became, you know, not only colleagues but friends. Day two of the shooting, we actually had an interesting scene where we were on a riverbank. She is suffering from Alzheimer's disease, and the scene is basically that she sees her reflection in the water, gets freaked out because she doesn't recognize herself, and has sort of a panic attack and meltdown. And in the script, she sort of, you know, has this meltdown and I constrain her. And the director, right before we shot, came over and said, just improv it, do what you want to do. And Karen paused for a moment. She looked around and she said, are you ready to play? I said, yeah, I guess so. We started the scene, Tom, she said, the first few lines, and then just entirely leapt in to this body of water, which was not in the script, was not in our preparation. And of course, just to play the reality of the scene, I leapt in directly behind her. And it was probably one of the most amazing, amazing scenes I've ever played as an actor, just the visceral reality of doing it. And certainly we bonded over that. So she's an amazing actor, and we had an amazing time together.
How was the water?
The water was cold, and both our microphones were destroyed in the process. Because we hadn't landed.
Well, Kevin, I don't want to let you go before I bring up something that I mentioned earlier, and that is your work on the Chautauqua circuit. That is, has I have experienced your portrayals of Daniel Boone and Jefferson Davis myself, and it was remarkable.
Thank you.
Are you continuing those and any other characters in the offing?
I am. That's actually sort of the bread and butter of my work as an actor right now. I do about 100 performances a year, Tom. Most of those are the Daniel Boone character. I travel to schools, universities, libraries, historical venues all over the state, all over the region, really. And it's been a challenge as an actor. They're both one-man shows, about 40 minutes long, and then they're followed by Q&A with the audience. But I get to travel the state, meet all sorts of interesting people. And most importantly, perhaps for me, is I get to go to pockets of the state and perform for kids that, honestly, Tom, I don't know if they've ever seen a theatrical performance, maybe live music, but it's not even a medium that they're familiar with. So my goal as an artist has always been to educate, entertain, and enlighten, and this Chautauqua really fuses my skill set, I think, to do all three of those things. And I also will be, I've been selected as the new Henry Clay for the Kentucky Humanities Council, and hopefully we'll debut that next August. So lots to do.
Lexington actor Kevin Hardesty, Joe, in the new film Not to Forget, shot right here in Kentucky. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.fm or esweku.com and on the WEKU mobile app. And we do like to hear from you. Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.